Yeah, hello, this is Rick Rozoff, a manager of the Stop NATO List. I want to thank you for the invitation to speak here today. Correct me at any point, anyone here, if I'm speaking off topic, but I understood from Joe that we would be talking about U.S. militarism, the threat to world peace posed by it, and related issues. Is that a general understanding?
Focusing on Syria.
Let me start real quickly. Just by way of backdrop to put things into perspective, I think I told Joe several years ago that when I was an infant, my mother was deported from the United States after being terrorized by FBI agents in our apartment. And I had to accompany her, of course, being an infant at the time, being breastfed. But this occurred against the background of the Korean War. And I think a lot of what we're seeing here domestically in the United States is inextricably linked with the war cycle that began in earnest certainly in 1991 with Operation Desert Storm against Iraq, and has continued uninterruptedly in that period. We are talking about, for example, the war in Afghanistan, which will be 11 years old on October the 7th. You know, it's the longest war in the history of the United States. So what we're talking about currently is that an unprecedented series of acts of military aggression by the United States, not episodic, not occasional, but constant and unrelenting. Last year, for example, the U.S. Defense Department, the greatest misnomer in the world. No, the U.S. Defense Department budget with, set-asides for Iraq and Afghanistan on top of the base budget was $729 billion. That works out to over $2,300 for each of the 300 million citizens of the United States. This is now in the fourth year of the worst economic crisis in the United States since the Great Depression, and we can afford to spend, or that is, the government can afford to spend, over $2,300 on every single citizen of the United States. Incidentally, adjusted for inflation, what are called constant dollars, that's the highest U.S. war budget since 1945, which is to say, World War II levels. This is 21 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, 25 years after the end of the Cold War, with not a single country in the world presenting a realistic challenge, much less a threat to the United States. The ruling elite in this country has spent World War II levels of funds from people desperately needed for jobs, for education, for health care, for infrastructural development, for all the causes we know that money is needed, on weapons of destruction and on using those weapons to kill people. That's the backdrop we have to see the Syrian crisis within. This is not an isolated episode. The U.S. has been hell-bent on overthrowing the government in Damascus since at least 2005. Which is to say, at the point at which Syrian troops were withdrawn from Lebanon, and comments were made by various high-ranking U.S. officials that this was, in so many words, the beginning of the end of the government in Syria. In other words, this predates by at least 7 years, actually over 7 years, or 6 years, the beginning of the unrest in Syria last year. So we have to, get our causality straight on this one, which came first. Developments in the Arab world and North Africa and the Middle East in the spring of last year simply created the pretext for the United States and its Western allies to fish in muddied waters, to exploit a crisis, to advance its own geopolitical and ultimately its own military objectives in the Middle East and nationally. One thing we cannot miss, this is so significant, it doesn't surprise me the establishment press doesn't pick up on it except to go into typical diatribes. But recently, Russia and China, two nuclear powers, of course, and two permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, for the third time, vetoed a resolution introduced by NATO powers in the UN Security Council that was targeting Syria for what could have been what's called an Article 7 United Nations action, which could include military intervention against Syria. This is unprecedented that two permanent members of the Security Council have vetoed three resolutions on the same subject. Going back to October, there was a second veto in February and one again recently. The U.S. has responded. In February, and Russia and China for the second time vetoed the punitive and, one could argue, resolution that was going to be preparation for military actions against Syria. The so-called Secretary of State, America's top diplomat, referred to Russia and China as being despicable. That's her term. On April the 6th, at a so-called Friends of Syria meeting in Paris, Clinton invites you to go to YouTube and watch it, you know, waving her arm in the air and acting almost like a banshee. Said that the problem is that Russia and China, keep in mind, this is the world's second largest economy, China, one of the world's two major military powers, and the only one with a nuclear arsenal and a triad of delivery systems that is comparable to that of the United States, Russia, says about both of them, the problem is, and I'm quoting here, they are not paying a price. They have got to be told that they will pay a price. This is gangster language. This is what you expect from, some street gang member telling you're going to pay your price if you don't, play along with the game. This is a point it's got to. Syria, in addition to what what's going on internally, and Syria simply as a topic in and of itself has become much larger now. This is the worst diplomatic and political to date confrontation with Russia and China since the Cold War. There's no question about that. And that the fact that both countries are being targeted simultaneously is something that has not occurred since before the Sino-Soviet split, 50 years ago. So this is the context we have to discuss these matters in. There has been a plethora of disinformation campaigns to, try to portray U.S. concern about developments within Syria, and particularly the well-being of the Syrian populace, is being another attempt to peddle a humanitarian intervention approach. And we've seen the results of these past humanitarian interventions. One need only go to Kosovo right now, the prototype for that, where the unemployment rate is officially in the area of 55% to 60%. Where there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of ethnic minorities savagely slain, at least 225,000 members of ethnic minorities chased out of the province, never to return. This is all under, by the way, the watch of NATO and the United States. The U.S. has built the largest overseas military base since the Vietnam War in Kosovo, Camp Bondsteel. So we know what humanitarian intervention looks like in terms of the results. We can also look at, we don't have to go back 13 years, we can look at what happened last year with Libya. Another humanitarian intervention. We now have the country riven with regional and ethnic and racial disputes. We have pogroms against Libyans who are of sub-Saharan ancestry, that is, black Libyans. We have another country that is going to find a hard time, if ever, being able to rebuild itself and reconstitute itself a nation. This is the plan in place for Syria right now. And after Syria, let's be clear about that. I'm jumping ahead, but I think this is also another context. If you will, this is a sequential rather than a geographic context. If the West succeeds in its objectives in Syria, which is to say overthrow of the government and implanting a puppet regime as they've done in several other countries over the past years, Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Libya, and so forth, let there be no doubt whatsoever, this will not be the last humanitarian intervention and regime change campaign. They instead will be emboldened to take on yet more and yet more dangers. Likely candidates for such a regime change policy, Belarus, Zimbabwe, and right here, much closer to home, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, Cuba, Nicaragua. Those would be the next likely target for this kind of campaign. And if it doesn't stop someplace, it's going to become increasingly more dangerous. The fact that the U.S. is willing, U.S. and its Western allies are willing to antagonize major powers like Russia and China, as they have, suggests they are so reckless, they don't care what the consequences are, they are hell-bent on achieving uncontested global domination, militarily, politically, economically, and otherwise. And such a reckless policy has to be reined in because it's a threat not only to regional peace in the Middle East, but ultimately to world peace. Now, the situation in Syria itself. We're seeing a replay of a typical subversion campaign that's been used in the Balkans, was used in Libya last year, has really been used, to be honest, for decades, if not generations. Similar efforts were used in Central America, were used in Angola, have been used in other countries around the world, where you divide and conquer, right? Where ethnic and religious groups are set against each other. And if you read the Western press, the establishment press, you're going to get the same crude, primitive, one-sided perspective on Syria, which is there's a tiny dictatorship of religious Alawites. that have dominated the country, regardless of a Sunni majority and so forth. That, number one, fails to take into account a very diverse mosaic of religious and ethnic groups within Syria. There are not only Alawites and other Shiites and Sunnis, there are Christians, there are ethnic Armenians, there are ethnic Assyrians. This is a very broad group, and it's not as simple as is being portrayed for us. For example, the suicide bombing that the United States endorses, I'm talking about the bombing in Damascus roughly a week and a half ago that killed four major government officials. The defense minister killed was a Christian. The deputy defense minister, if I'm not mistaken, was a Sunni. Assad's wife is a Sunni, and so forth. So this, you know, this image we have of an religious minority, ruthlessly running a country at the expense of the majority, you know, simply is not true. If we want a real scenario along those lines, we can look at nearby Bahrain, where some 70% of the people of a Shiite religious background being dominated not only by a Sunni minority, but by a medieval monarchy. That is one of the grossest violators of human rights and democratic rights in any conceivable sense of the word. But Bahrain is a major friend and ally of the United States. The Khalifa family, you know, epitomized Western transparency and democratic values and so forth. As a matter of fact, the last defense secretary, Robert Gates, was in Bahrain visiting with the Khalifa family, you know, the royal family, the very day before Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates sent 2,500 troops in to help suppress peaceful protests by Bahrainis. So, I mean, I'm just, mentioning these things by way of contrast so that we can really look at the Syrian situation, you know, in a realistic perspective and not, fall victim to the one-sided, accounts that are being rendered by government officials in the West and their ever-obedient media. Second of all, you've read it yourself, you've heard it yourself, the expression that the road to Tehran, the capital of Iran, runs through Damascus. Not only is the U.S. exploiting the Syrian crisis and prolonging that crisis and adding to the amount of Syrian civilians who are killed on a weekly basis to challenge, confront, and they hope, isolate and humiliate Russia and China, they are also, attempting by overthrowing the government in Syria to eliminate the only government in the Arab world that Iran can consider to be a reliable ally at this point. That is, of the 22 members of the Arab League currently, Syria alone there are forces in other Arab countries, of course, that friendly relations, political parties, Hezbollah certainly, with Iran, but the only government that has such close relations is Syria. If the Syrian government is knocked out, Iran loses its own major, its only major governmental ally in the Arab world. So does Russia, which moreover has its only overseas military installation outside the former Soviet Union in Syria, in Tartus. So the West has a number of important geopolitical designs in terms of Syria. It wants to expedite and finish off, a project that began really 11 years ago with the George W. Bush administration's announced initially broader Middle East, later greater Middle East, and then Condoleezza Rice as of 2005, new Middle East policy, which basically says, the broader Middle East, let's get a picture of this, is not simply the Arab world. It extends from Mauritania on the Atlantic coast of West Africa to Kazakhstan, which borders Russia and China. That's the greater Middle East. And that's what, from 2001 onward, U.S. Government officials and policymakers have determined is going to be transformed in a manner that better suits U.S. Designs. So the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the establishment of U.S. and NATO military bases in former Soviet Central Asia, in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, military penetration of Pakistan, the drone war and counterinsurgency war inside Somalia, the drone war and counterinsurgency war within Yemen, the war against Libya last year, and the subversion of Syria right now are all part of that broader Middle East initiative, as it was originally called by the Bush administration. The old saw or the old cliche that with the United States, political differences end at the water's edge has never been more true, I think, than the seamless continuation and actually escalation of this broader Middle East policy that went from the George W. Bush administration to the Obama administration and will be intensified yet further unless we stop it under whoever gets elected this November. So, in addition to the threat to Iran, Iran will be isolated, the U.S. And its allies include, incidentally, not just their European NATO partners. You know, France, Italy, Germany, and other Britain have participated in some of the other wars I've discussed, all of whom have troops in Afghanistan currently. It also includes, NATO's adjunct in the Arab world, which is the members of the Gulf Cooperation Council. And again, if we know people, and I'm sure we all do, who believe for a moment that the U.S. is interested in fostering and expanding democracy in the Arab world, one need only look at the closest and most reliable political and military allies the U.S. and the NATO countries as a whole have in the Arab world, and they're the six members of the Gulf Cooperation Council. They are, to a one, theocratic monarchies. They are Saudi Arabia, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and who am I leaving out? Kuwait. Now, during the bombing of Libya, about 2 months into it last year, the only other two monarchies in the Arab world, Morocco, which is on the Atlantic Ocean, Jordan, which is nowhere near the Persian Gulf, applied for membership in the Gulf Cooperation Council. Jordan and Morocco were in Paris with Hillary Clinton to launch the war against Libya last year at a so-called Friends of Libya meeting. Now it's Friends of Syria. Tomorrow it'll be Friends of Iran or Friends of Venezuela or Friends of Zimbabwe or Friends of whomever. So that what the U.S. and its NATO allies have done is to bring together the eight monarchies in the Arab world into one fold. Qatar and United Arab Emirates, employed French and other NATO nations built warplanes for the bombing of Libya last year. Those two countries, as well as Saudi Arabia, are actively involved in the subversion campaign against Syria now. So we have to look at this new, I called it at one point, an unholy alliance, modeled after, the defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe in 1815, where all the reactionaries in Europe, all the monarchies, got together and formed the so-called Holy Alliance to make sure never again, would republicanism, much less socialism, rear its head in Europe, and that they would conspire against it. This is precisely what the U.S. and its Western European allies are doing in conjunction with the most reactionary, the most brutal, the most, definitively anti-democratic governments in the world. You saw recently where a member of the House of Saud died, and Obama immediately picks up the phone to express the most heartfelt condolences towards our strategic ally in the Middle East. So this just so we know how seriously to take this concern about fostering democracy in Syria or any place else. It's a charade. Now, I made allusion earlier to the 11-year-old global war on terrorism, which has been, if not officially, renamed Overseas Contingency Operations by the Obama administration. They certainly have better public relations people working for them. They come up with better names as they continue firing Hellfire missiles into northwest Pakistan, where the death toll now is someplace in the neighborhood of 3,000 people, which is to say more people have been killed, arguably, in U.S. drone attacks in Pakistan, northwest Pakistan, just in the last 8 years, since 2004. Than were killed in the United States on September the 11th, 2001. Let that sink in. In the name of combating terrorism, and if we go back a little bit to 2001, we have to recall after the attacks in New York and Washington that Donald Rumsfeld, then Defense Secretary, stated there was something in the neighborhood of 63 countries harboring terrorists. And that a country that harbored terrorists was no better than a terrorist, essentially, and that the U.S. reserved the right to strike those countries. 63 countries is roughly a third of the countries in the world. We also have to recall, and I think this is relevant to what was discussed earlier today, that immediately at that time the Bush administration exploited the events of 9/11 to target, by no means, simply the countries that were harboring the sorts of suspects that he was accusing, but to go after every genuine liberation struggle in the world by branding them terrorists and somehow linking them with al-Qaeda. This included not only secular, but particularly Marxist political movements in countries like Colombia, Palestine, the Philippines, and elsewhere. So this gave the U.S. a chance, if you will, to finish off the Cold War. Much of what we've seen in the last 15 or so years has been just that. You know, with no opposition, with the end of the bipolar world, with no former Soviet Union or Socialist Bloc or anyone else to stand in the way of U.S. expansion, not only has the U.S. built military installations in part of the world that, 10 or 15 years ago would have been absolutely inconceivable. For example, starting in 2005 and the following year, the U.S. has gained 8 military bases in Bulgaria and Romania. Those are the first U.S. military bases on the territory of former Warsaw Pact countries. 2 years ago, we set up an interceptor missile battery in Poland with 100 U.S. troops. I think yesterday was the third anniversary of the world's first multinational strategic airlift operation, which is based in Hungary. We now have bases in, as I mentioned, Kyrgyzstan, Afghanistan. U.S. has recently gained access to bases in Australia, Singapore. There's talk right now about the U.S. going back into Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam. There's been talk from Filipino sources recently that U.S. military forces are going to regain the use of the Clark Air Force Base and the Subic Naval Base in the Philippines. U.S. already has base camps and troops fighting a counterinsurgency war in Mindanao in the Philippines. So what we have is, the Syrian situation right now, in a very real sense, this is a line that has to be drawn in the sand. Thus far, no farther. U.S. and allied efforts to topple one of the few governments in the world that they don't have complete control over, that is not a military, that has never been a military partner of the United States. It's almost alone in the Arab world in that respect. That we have to be as clear and unequivocal as we can be. No U.S. And allied military intervention in Syria, surely. No provision of arms and support to so-called rebel groups within Syria. A UN brokered if need be, but some sort of neutral parties, to broker a solution within the country and to prevent this thing from blowing up into a regional conflict that only includes Iran, but would inevitably spill over the borders into Iraq, Turkey, and Jordan. Thank you. The question was, with the increasingly uncompromising and even threatening language and actions by the United States aimed at Russia and China, is there a prospect of Russia and China saying, we're going to strike first, or, faced with an inevitable attack by the United States, would we take military action first? I certainly hope it never gets to that point. There are any number of intermediate steps that can and should be employed to prevent it ever getting to that point. There are not only diplomatic actions, there are, actions to rally the world's forces, which right now I think, by default more than anything else, have kind of fallen into the U.S. column. Not that, Washington doesn't have tremendous influence through international lending and financial institutions, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the World Bank. Not that it does not have, what is an historically unprecedented military presence, by the way. For anyone who doesn't know this, the U.S. Alone in history has arrogated to itself the right to divide up the world into six so-called unified combatant commands. And that two of those seven have been set up in the last 10 years. Northern Command in 2002 and Africa Command in 2008. Africa Command takes in more nations than any other U.S. overseas military command, 53 countries. And this has all happened, more than a decade after the end of the Cold War, at a time where we're assured, there's no need for military expansion, and it's been counterintuitive. Exactly the opposite has occurred. Russia and China have, by vetoing three resolutions in succession in the UN Security Council, I think at least delivered the message that if we rolled over last year for Libya, we are not doing it this time for Syria. That's number one. Number two, we have learned the lessons, I hope, of Libya and of Iraq and of Afghanistan and of Yugoslavia, and we don't want any more. Or, as a prominent Russian Middle East expert put it in an article a few days ago, if Syria falls, Iran is next, and there'll be a Russian spring on our own doorstep. I think there's a realization of that in China as well as Russia. And the question was, if the West and their Arab allies in the Gulf succeed in overthrowing the government in Damascus, how will it affect the Palestinian liberation movement? I don't see it can affect it in any positive manner. I think one of the major sources of support, diplomatically, materially, open to Palestinian forces, and I'm talking not so much about Fatah. I am talking about the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, that those groups would have not only one less base of support, but they may eventually have none, outside of Palestinian territory. So that in and of itself is negative for the Palestinian movement. Second of all, something has been happening behind the scenes. We have to realize that the Arab League expelled Syria. The League of Arab States expelled Syria and before that Libya. I, for one, don't believe that the 22-member Arab League would have taken those measures except on the initiative of the Gulf monarchies I talked about earlier. And that what, in fact, is occurring within Palestine itself is a lot of Saudi money and a lot of Qatari money is coming in and is buying off officials. We just have to be clear about that. And that's true with the Palestinian National Authority in the first instance. And I think, there's a certain amount of defeatism around the world. There does not have to be, but I think there's been a tendency to say that there's one world superpower right now and we had better accommodate ourselves to it, strike the best deal we can with it because there's no alternative. It's precisely the alternative that has to be dealt with, and I hope I answered part of that, in reference to Russia and China forming a potential nucleus in terms of on the governmental level. I mean, there are a lot of other ways this can happen. With political movements, political parties, and others around the world, especially in the age of the internet, integrating our efforts and forming, if you will, an international resistance front. The question was the role of Turkey in relation to the campaign against Syria in general, but particularly the role of Turkey threatening to replicate in Syria what it has been doing for years in northern Iraq, which is launching deadly military attacks against Kurdish targets, particularly members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party. I believe that's, in essence, a question. We do have to recall that as Turkey, went to NATO headquarters, went to a NATO command structure just about 2.5 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, to seek, the support from the 28-member military alliance to defend itself against Syria, which is absurd. Because one of its warplanes, intentionally flying low and at high velocity over Syrian territory, was shot down, which is the standard procedure under those circumstances. And this was viewed as an act of aggression against Turkey. But many of us have pondered or speculated since March of last year, March of 2011, that the U.S. and its allies would use Turkey as the frontline state, to create the pretext for a NATO war against Freudian slip, against Syria, because it's the only nation in the area that is a member of NATO. We have to keep in mind that not only does Turkey border Syria, it borders Iran. And that in January of this year, the Turkish government permitted the U.S. to base what's called an X-band transportable radar station in Turkey, which is part of the European U.S. NATO, but ultimately part of the U.S. global interceptor missile system, what's been referred to as Son of Star Wars, and with good reason. I mean, it is an attempt to implement the Ronald Reagan Strategic Defense Initiative of creating an impregnable missile shield that permits the U.S. to threaten other countries or launch first strikes against other countries and then not fear retaliation. So, one U.S. official at the time, incidentally, actually last year when Turkey agreed to host that radar station, said this is the most substantial act of U.S.-Turkish military cooperation in the past 30 years. We have to see that against the backdrop of what the Turkish government has been saying over the past couple of years about its independent foreign policy and so forth. However, in the case of Iraq, let's contrast, Turkish statements that they are threatened by Syria because, some refugees have spilled across the border from Syria to Turkey. A couple, 3 weeks ago, the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, said, hold on a moment, you're talking about 30,000 Syrian refugees in Turkey. There are 500,000 Palestinian refugees in Syria and 1 million Iraqi refugees in Syria. You don't talk about that. But what Turkey has been doing is launching, you know, blistering, deadly air attacks, ground attacks within, you know, a sovereign nation, Iraq, with U.S. warplanes, U.S. Authorization. The U.S. agrees with Turkey in characterizing the Kurdistan Workers' Party as a terrorist organization and is materially aiding and abetting the United States' efforts to exterminate it. Would Turkey do something similar in Syria? They could very well use that as a pretext. All they have to claim is some Turkish armed formation crossed the border and fired a couple bullets, and that would be the excuse Turkey would use to invade northern Syria. The question was, and the question is actually contained within itself a much better answer than I could give. And it was a question about whether in the Syrian opposition, both internally and abroad, but I would imagine particularly internally, there are forces who want a change in the political system in Syria, but just as firmly oppose outside intervention. I would have to assume there are. I mean, I have Syrian friends in Chicago from Syria, who have relatives in Syria, but, you know, that's anecdotal. That I can't say that's, you know, general sentiment. I can tell you this, that you mentioned some of the political parties. I think that the left political parties within Syria, particularly the Marxist parties, adopt some variation of the position that you're explaining to me, which is there is a necessity to expand the government, to kind of break the not so much longer monopoly, but dominance of the Ba'ath Party, the ruling Ba'ath Party, and to open the political system up. These are the sorts of opposition groups you mentioned, Russia, that in fact have gone to Moscow and have met with Russian officials repeatedly. And, you know, one of the reasons Russia is so appalled by the U.S. position is that, you know, Syria is a long-term political and military ally of Russia going back to Soviet times. And one can even question from the Syrian perspective, it wasn't an act of, disloyalty to welcome these opposition figures in Moscow. Russia nevertheless did that, only to be excoriated by the likes of Hillary Clinton and be called despicable and be told they have to pay a price. So, and then being told, and this is the worst of it, is that Russia is responsible for prolonging the bloodshed in Syria. Whereas, in fact, Russia has met with opposition figures to try to broker some agreement along the lines of what you suggest, which is a peaceful internal compromise solution within Syria. When Russia and other countries attempt to do that, the U.S. sabotages it, ensures that the bloodshed not only continues but intensifies, and then blames Russia and other countries for the bloodshed in Syria. This is, you know, you want to use the word despicable, I think this is a case where it's justified. I have to assume it's done with the knowledge and probably permission of the government in Damascus.